I'm Rachel from Tyrion's Landing, a podcast member of the Gunna Geek Network, just like the one you're listening to now. The opinions expressed are those of each individual. Check out all the other podcasts at GunnaGeekNetwork.com and get ready, because geekiness begins in 3, 2, 1.
This is Gemma Redgrave, and you're listening to Gallifrey Public Radio.
Welcome to Gallifrey Public Radio, a podcast dedicated to everything in the Doctor Who spectrum. We invite you to join us each week for discussions ranging from Hartnell to Capaldi and beyond. Your GPR staff are Jay Witten.
You see how clever I was there? You make that connection? Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
Keir Hansen.
Proactive. Reactive. Proactive. I'm making up words as I go here.
And Haley Malley.
Hey, that wasn't exactly what I was going to say at all, Jay. Thanks.
Oh, and
spoilers.
We do occasionally discuss recent news and rumors, as well as episodes that have already aired in their home territories. But don't worry. If we dip too far into the future, we'll give you fair warning.
Welcome to episode 238 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where, as legend has it, if you stand in the fields of heather on a gray early dawn, you might hear strains of drums and bagpipes carried across the highland winds. And once every 100 years, legend has it that an incredible thing will be visible through the fog, a gift hidden by time. Oh, wait, that's the plot to Brigadoon. Never mind.
Go home with Bobby Jean.
I am Jay, and with me in the GPR studios this week is Keir. How are you doing, Keir?
I love barbarians.
And standing guarding the door is Haley. How are you doing?
Guys, can it be somebody else's turn?
I really got to go to the bathroom. Just cover me for 5 minutes.
This week, we will spend some time in the Doctor's not-quite-favorite holiday spot, Aberdeen, with a slight adjustment to the calendar. A dozen or more centuries, in fact. Last writing for Doctor Who in the Sylvester McCoy era, Rona Monroe returns to New Who with the Eaters of Light. It's an adventure to learn the mystery of the lost 9th Roman Legion, and of course, nothing can just be as simple as a glance over a hillside to get our answer.
Wouldn't that been something? Just, I always wanted to know. Okay, well, let's go there. Let's peek over the hill. Yep, it's a battle. They're all dead. Okay, let's go.
All right, what's next? Any other bets to settle?
Swindon. Yeah, so trailer, you know, painted this a pretty clear picture. Yeah. Of what we were going to get. We thought, okay, historical adventure, straight up, just going to go chase down this strange mystery. It's like looking for the, one of the lost village or something of that sort, you know, and you try to see what the nature of it is. And it turns out to be something a little more complicated than you expected. But with this, we get a little bit of bonus.
Yeah.
From our primary characters.
Yeah. I mean, this was a lot of fun because it was straight up historical. There was a lot of, a lot of stuff that was drawn straight from the history books and then expounded upon. So, I mean, we got some really interesting and exciting characters. We got some insight into our main characters, and then we get a little fun alien twist.
Yeah. Which really seemed to be kind of just off to the side. I mean, the alien threat to me, the idea of these locusts, was kind of secondary, really, right. As is often the case when you end up with something that really's got some interesting characters, especially secondary characters to dig into, like Carr and the rest of the, what were they? They kept being referred to as barbarians. Did we get a name for this sort of Celtic band? Picts. Okay. I guess I was really, from the beginning, interested in Bill's fascination with the, you know, as a sort of a history buff on this. I mean, we know that she's far more intelligent than she gets the opportunity to really exercise, based on all the, you know, the papers that she submitted for the Doctor and so forth, even before he became her tutor. And you know, but this seems to be something she chose. This was one of those, almost like we're catching the other side of the coin to a, yeah, tell me where you want to go. I'll take you anywhere.
Exactly.
You
know, yeah.
Let me show you what this can do. And this is kind of that adventure. But instead of saying, oh, I want to go to the future. Well, we did that and it turned out dangerous. Let's go to the past. What could possibly go wrong?
We know what
the
happened.
The past was always so safe.
We know exactly what's going to happen. Nothing can harm us.
Of course. That's why they're all still alive now.
We're protected by forethought.
But yeah, so we get this interesting insight on Bill, you know, the fact that she, you know, she really finds this stuff so fascinating. But then we also, as a result of all the things that transpire, we get a really interesting insight on the Doctor, both through Bill's eyes, you know, she calls him out on a few things, and then also just his actions and where he leaps in with regard to this barbarian group that has been forced to guard over this gate in the cairn. I wanted to bring this up because it seems like something a couple people have brought up to us. Actually, just had this conversation this morning with two other Whovians, where they were saying it seems like he's sort of falling into going from not just a hero fetish into something where he seemed willingly or voluntarily throwing himself into harm's way to mortal end, or just writing himself off in this desire to keep everyone from harm. You know, he began as soon as he kind of recognized the fact that he bears this face because it's a reminder that he has to do everything within his power to make sure that even the, you know, the lowest life gets saved. It was a rocky start with that realization, and now it's at the point where he's sacrificing himself right and left, and it's everyone else that's pulling him back. Is this just like a buildup for what we know is going to be the finale here?
The way that I kind of figured it when I realized what was going on is it almost seems like he's recognizing the harm that he tends to put people in, like that he tends to put people in harm's way, that, you know, he's constantly taking his companions on these adventures where they're in danger, the, you know, all these different things happen, and he saves the world time and time again, but at what cost? And so this was his chance to be like, you know what, now I can continually save the world and nobody else has to suffer for it.
Right. Yeah. I guess is it because of, or I should say, what has been ramping it up so intensely within, you know, this middle third of the season here? Is it because of all of the danger that he's specifically put Bill through? Or is it something you think where it might have to do with, and we're going to spend a lot of time discussing this in a few minutes, the therapy sessions that he's working through with Missy may also be doing some good for him. Well, good, I should say. He's doing some soul searching on his own. It's a little different than the am I a good man conversation anymore. And now it's into the what is my purpose?
Yeah.
So which do you think is driving that faster?
I think it goes back to him not wanting to endanger those that are around him as much anymore. Like if there's something dangerous that is going to be done, he's going to put himself in that position before anybody else.
Okay. Was there some sort of a shift in the collateral damage department as far as his tolerance for, or at least his acceptance of the loss of life? If something happens in the heat of it, like remember Thin Ice, you know, you get a death that happens right in front of you. He brushes it off really quickly, and it leads to this big conversation between himself and Bill about, you know, about his callous sort of response to it, you know, and in his response, there's only so much you can do. You can either wallow in it, you can move on from it. But this, is that changing, or is it really just a matter of he's really starting to recognize the value of those that he's sworn to protect? And if he comes into a situation where there's already mortal peril, he's there to, you know, to save who he can. You know, I'm seeing a little bit of an imbalance, and I know that it's a different sort of interpretation as it gets placed into each writer's hands. I just find it's kind of interesting that this time around, in Rhoda Monroe's hands, when her last episode written was Survival, which had a lot to do with the idea of putting yourself better, you know, bettering yourself than the animals. I mean, granted, we're dealing with the cheetah people in the whole episode, and it had its kind of moments, but it had to do with the idea of recognizing the humaneness of humanity in the face of danger and the desire for your own personal survival. So that's kind of something that kind of runs through a lot of her approach to this text. I wonder if this is a matter of progression from writer to writer, or whether it's just a matter of it just happens to be laying out that as these writers say, okay, I'm writing for Peter Capaldi, I'm writing for the 12th Doctor, and this is what I've learned from him, and this is my backdrop, so I'm going to work with, you know, with this character construct, and they all seem to be kind of headed towards the same place.
Mm-hmm.
Does it seem pattern-oriented, or do you think that there's a governing hand at work?
I don't know. It's hard to say. It could go... I mean, there's arguments for either side. Mm.
Well, in thinking of a possible bigger picture for this series, it's possible that we're seeing all season his willingness to be the one to put himself up as the sacrifice. And we're going to get a resolution to that with, you know, he's willing to put himself up as the sacrifice. And then that's where we find out that Missy really is on his side. And she steps in kind of the way that River did in the library and doesn't let him sacrifice himself and takes his place for that instead.
So instead of someone coming in and reminding him that you're required for greater things, you serve a greater purpose, then this time around, it's a matter of, you can't always be the sacrificial lamb, because that means that further down the line, others are being robbed of the benefit of knowing you, of having you interact with their lives. So he needs to be reminded of his own self-worth?
Yeah, that's one way of looking at it.
He does seem kind of rough on himself this entire season. Granted, you know, he's catching himself on a lot of critical errors of judgment that, you know, may or may not want to call them doctor-like decisions. But nonetheless, it seems like every time he's being taught something, it's hitting him pretty hard. And maybe he's just ending up in a lower and lower state, to the point where he's now, as a result of him, as you were saying, working with Missy to say, all right, you want to be good, you want to find the good within you, you need to find it on your own accord. It has to be something that is unprompted. It has to emerge organically, and it has to be heartfelt and true and so forth. But at the same time, he's realizing that the goodness that he's attempting to do is only as valuable as his persistence, or his continued existence. So maybe he needs that reminder.
Well, and we talked at the beginning of this season kind of wondering how long he had been not traveling as the Doctor. And I wonder if that absence from his usual adventuring and saving the worlds and all of that has made him forget all the good that he can and does do. And this series is kind of him being reminded of that.
Okay. He sort of went into a hermit mode for a little while. Well, I don't know. Oh, we got the same thing from Smith's Doctor when he went and disappeared, you know, and it was...
up in the clouds.
Yeah, and how that turned out. Rather than adventuring alone, mm-hmm. which Smith's Doctor had also had the opportunity. So if you're going to be on your own, which is the, you know, which is... is there any good place to be when you're on your own? You know, either sitting still or constantly on the move, it seems like it never seems to work out for him either way. He just has to be surrounded by those that value him and that he values. And maybe that's kind of the thematic reminder of what we're getting this season. Jumping back to the episode itself. We're going to mention this in the news. There was some heated discussion as a result of some things that Mr. Gatiss had said about his casting decisions, or the casting decisions that were made regarding his episode. This time around, it was absolutely across the board. I thought it was an extremely credible, diverse cast, for at least for representation for the Ninth Legion. Mm-hmm. Had no bearing on anything. He just totally accepted it. Nothing was written in any particular light. And I thoroughly enjoyed it, because I didn't care or notice, mm-hmm. really, until about the second watching. Like, all right, well, okay. And the only reason why it did stand out in the second watching was because of the news item from the week prior.
Right. No, I mean, the only thing that really caught me for half a second was when the Roman soldiers just accepted the fact that Bill is gay in stride.
I love that little scene.
I mean, it caught me off guard for a second. Then I'm like, oh, wait, no, yeah, the Romans were pretty much very open-minded about that kind of. So, yeah, no, it fits.
I'm really glad they didn't get into some of the weirder things of the Romans. But yeah, absolutely. I thought that was a great scene to have. For those of you who are railing against the fact that, oh, I don't want social justice issues in my Doctor Who. Well, I'm sorry. I don't know what you've been watching for the past 52 years, but whatever. It ends up getting us to... I think the only thing out of that scene that struck me as weird is when they said that the leader of the group, the captain of the group, or sort of the only the the one who was recognized as their leader, was 18 because he was the oldest. He was almost 18.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, no, that guy at the back looks like he's about 25. but it sets us up for that great moment where Bill realizes that the doctor sort of sees all of these other races as childlike in their behaviors and their decisions. Huge eye-opening moment for her. I don't know if that's ever been really called out in Doctor Who before, that particular analogy.
Well, he never really called it. It was Bill recognizing it. She's like, no, we can all understand each other. So now what do you sound like? And then she put it together and she's like, you understand everybody in the universe. That's why everybody seems like kids to you. Mm-hmm. And the doctor just kind of like, you know, nods his head. And yeah, that's pretty much it.
Yeah. And it's a fascinating statement. It's one I'm so glad that it made about the value of open communication and open dialogue. You know, doctor shows up with his TARDIS translation, and all of a sudden, these two sides that have been at each other's throats can suddenly recognize that they're very, very similar, and that, you know, one is defending their homeland, and the other is doing, you know, it's following orders, and that nice adage. But I think that's an excellent statement about the doctor, about what he has to do when he comes into these situations and he's listening to both sides and he's, you know, doing the ping pong match back and forth and realizing you're all just absolutely unfathomably immature and ill-prepared for what you're attempting to do. I'm really glad that she gets that bit of insight too. Nardal, yeah. Though, can I ask? This is probably one of his weakest episodes, in my opinion.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
I don't know if it was just a matter of strictly served as comedy relief.
Yeah, I almost wonder if he wasn't like originally in the script and was added later.
That would make more sense.
Yeah, maybe this was a script concept that Monroe had that she maybe pitched before Nardal was in the mix and then had to make the edits. I could understand that. Not that I didn't find him entertaining.
Mm-hmm.
It just seemed like it was just sort of pasted in.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Because I mean, but, really, the only thing he contributed was pointing out, like, oh, look, the crows actually do say something.
And the popcorn. He brought the popcorn.
Exactly.
That was true. Yeah. That was a tell me that didn't just reek of McCoy era kind of gimmicks.
Oh, yeah.
Going to create a distraction. I'm going to wait for you all to jump out of your skins. Perfect. But yet he had even more popcorn. He threw that back into the fire and they were all eating popcorn later.
You don't ever,
they probably went back to the TARDIS and got some more.
You don't ever bring just one bag of popcorn. Come on.
Never, never.
Novice.
But okay, so this is what we've been waiting to discuss. So we return to the TARDIS and she's loose. She's loose.
She is loose, yeah.
Ish.
Not only loose, but being given tasks to accomplish.
She's the mechanic. She's the Kaylee of the TARDIS now.
Oh, God.
Yep. She's probably got a hammock down there in the engine room.
She probably does. I wouldn't be surprised. She'd be the type to sleep in a hammock.
The doctor was going to send Nardal and Bill back on their own, not knowing that Missy was waiting in the TARDIS.
Okay.
That was his grand plan.
Yeah.
Well, they'll figure it out sooner or later.
So biologically locked out of the controls
and that'll work
from the doors. Oh, sure.
She'll never be able to figure out her way around that.
But she has complete access to everything else. Missy in the library. That's going to be a problem. All right. So as we get into that exchange, okay, and then all of a sudden scene jumps to her down in the lower section of the control room. And she's crying. It seemed very quick. I mean, it was a very quick take.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering whether there might have been an interstitial scene there somewhere, because the jump seemed very quick emotionally for her. And you get the explanation after the fact. I don't understand why this is happening. You know, I'm crying at the drop of a hat now. We're still wondering the genuine nature of this conversion, this therapy, this grand reawakening, and the value of that friendship. Have we shifted at all in our position about how true we think she's being and how valid this all is? Or are we holding steady that, I knew this was going to be it all along?
Yeah, I don't know. It's just because this thread seems to be what Moffat is weaving through it all. So, you know, like the little tags on the end like this, I'm fairly certain are Moffat's hand in each one of the episodes. Mm-hmm. And Moffat can't help but try and be clever. So yes, let's put Missy in the vault because that's the obvious thing, because they're never going to suspect that, you know, she's actually going to save John Sim's life and negate her existence altogether. It's that kind of thing. Like he's going to come up with something off the wall that's brilliant once we see it, but we're never going to see coming.
Since Missy was introduced as the new master, she has wanted the Doctor as her friend again. You know, when she brought in the Cybermen to try and take over the world, that was the army she was going to give the Doctor to have him be her friend again. Like, everything, even when she's doing evil things, when she's trying to be good, you know, it's all about getting her friend back. Mm-hmm. Which, that's why I kind of came to the conclusion that she might sacrifice herself to save the Doctor. She knows she can't, you know, long run, maintain this walking the straight and narrow path, but she can in a moment sacrifice herself to save her friend.
Right. Well, it leads me back to wonder, you know, Moffat is sort of cleaning the slate as he works his way through. You know, we've heard, you know, decisions that certain characters are not going to be returning because they were his creations, and he's closing the books on them, you know, systematically as he goes. River Song. Okay. Chapter ended. Missy, Michelle Gomez is not going to be returning. Okay, so some way we're going to close that. You know, I brought her in. I'm going to take her out. Whether he's queuing up for whether we even see another master before it all is said and done, before Series 10 closes out, or it's left as some sort of a hanging mystery out there so the Chibnall can choose to do a kind of a Saxon crazy reveal somewhere a season or two into his tenure is entirely up to him. The Sim thing, well, all right, well, we were going to be saving this for the news. We'll include it in the news links, but do we want to just put the big, spoiler sign up and talk about the trailer for next week? Or do we want to just leave that off and close the books on this one first?
Let's close this one out.
Okay. I kind of had one more thing to say about that scene at the end. The Doctor says, "You'll never learn to hear the music," which reminded me that when we were introduced to Sim's master, we find that the master became the way he is because of the drums he heard, because of the music that he heard in the universe. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Interesting.
That was driving him mad because he couldn't not hear it.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Good catch.
Okay.
Which is fuel for the fire that Missy is actually the interstitial that gets us the Sim, which means that the Yana Doctor... Wait, okay. Well, we're back into that loop again.
Yeah.
More on that shortly. We're never going to take it away from Stephen Moffat that he can weave a complex and very rewarding story arc. You know, he's clever. The guy is clever, mm-hmm. and he knows how to pull threads, and he knows how to draw upon hints and breadcrumbs that he's dropped along the way, or he leverages things that he's used before that he was kind of floating as ideas that didn't really pan out at the time, but he finds a way to use them later so it seems as though he was, you know, weaving this complex tapestry all along. But if we're looking at something like this, where there's some sort of crazy loop back that goes all the way back into RTD era, that would be a masterstroke, pun intended. Because now we're doing something where, you know, he had RTD into the know, which is possible. I mean, Russell says he already knows who the 13th Doctor is. So, you know, they're in league with one another to a certain degree. They probably float ideas past each other every once in a while. But yeah, that would really kind of throw things on their ear, because now handing it over to Chibnall, it's like these two previous showrunners said, "Oh man, we had all these crazy things going. You saw things going on over here. I was making balloon animals over here, and he was spinning plates over in this side, and you didn't even see the flaming hoops over on that side. Here, have a show," and just dumps it in his lap and says, "Okay, now you've got to create characters and storylines as complex and rewarding or at least engaging as what we just did for the past 10 years. Have fun."
Yeah.
Poor Chibnall. Before we get to the news that's intrinsically related to everything that we've been discussing and that we want to continue to discuss, because the last 10 minutes of this past episode tease us into what we're expecting for the next episode, which is bonkers, and we'll get to that. Since as we are recording tonight, it is Father's Day, I figured I'd play a little bit of a very quick game with you. You guys up for this?
Sure.
Okay. Real, real simple. Sort of a daddy daycare thing. So think about all the fathers that we've been introduced to. In Doctor Who. Good, bad, indifferent, you know, heroic, weak, fun, stoic, everything in between. Think about your superlatives here. So, off the top of your head, don't think about this too hard. Probably don't even have to explain it that hard, because we'll let the listeners chime in and tell us if we're full of crap, and then we can defend ourselves in the comments. The overall best Whovian father on record, the dad you wish you had. Haley, I'm going to give that to you first.
Brian Williams.
Okay. Do you want to explain that, or you just say, you know, it is Brian Williams?
There's no explanation needed.
I get to drive him around on a golf cart. Jay, what would you take me?
That was actually what I had written down, too.
Okay.
Just, you cannot go wrong with Brian.
I'm going with Wilfred Mott, because, I mean, I love Brian to death, and he's just... he's just such an enjoyable character. And he did take good care of Rory. You know, carry a trowel. You know, instilled good fatherly advice on him.
See,
but Wilfred Mott just showed this dedication and this passion and always wanting to see better. That's where I go. Worst Whovian dad. Absolute worst. Jay, I'll give you first crack at that one.
I am going with Clive Jones, Martha's dad.
Yeah.
Because you only see him like once. He's not there for the kids' real special occasion stuff. It's really he serves no purpose aside from the fact that, yep, you were there at conception.
Okay. Haley, worst Whovian father.
Jack Harkness.
Oh, God. I mean, you know he's got to be, but I really hope not.
No, we met his daughter, remember?
Oh, that's true. Yeah. No. I had blocked that series
and then
out. Thanks.
She took her son and sacrificed it. Do you not remember this? Kind of a plot point.
I blocked it out. Okay, too painful.
Yeah. Well, or technically, worst Whovian granddad, maybe.
I don't think he's a great father either.
Yeah. If you're gonna steal your daughter's only son and sacrifice him, really doesn't qualify you for world's okayest dad mug.
Yeah. How about the most fun Whovian dad? Which you go in any direction with this, but the dad that you'd want to go adventure with, camping with,
to
the movies with.
This is where I put Wilf, because Wilf is a lot of fun. Exactly.
<Yep.
laughs> I'm doing my little Wilfred Mott hand wavy thing here.
Works great on an audio podcast.
It does. Just picture it. Haley?
Craig Owens.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was wondering if we were going to end up getting him involved here. But yeah, he ended up being more fun as a result. I would say that he's probably a pretty good candidate for best Whovian dad, because he saved the world with the love of Stormageddon. The world.
There's some good dads in this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. This is actually where I used Brian Williams for most fun.
Okay.
Because I think he's just his quirkiness, his overt dadliness, keeping logs, being meticulous about things. You know, I've got to, just has to be careful. Just, you got to be prepared. It's Wednesday. Are you wearing your Wednesday underwear? You know, that's classic dad. That's fun.
Can anyone tell that here is thoroughly enjoying his new role as dad on his very first Father's Day?
Oh, yeah. Let's see.
Anything inherently dad is just the greatest thing in the world to him.
Yeah. I was going through a whole bevy of dad jokes today to work on my repertoire. Yeah. Told me that I had to stop pretending I was a flamingo. So I put my foot down. Yeah. All right. Least fun Whovian dad. We'll round this one out. Who do you think was the least fun? Not worst, necessarily, but could be.
Just not fun.
Just not fun.
Haley?
This one I had a harder time thinking of. So I just went with Caecilius because he was a dad I could think of that I don't remember having any fun.
It's exactly what I have written down here. Lobus Caecilius.
All right.
That's my last one there.
See, I went with Pete Tyler.
Yeah, I thought about him.
Not a bad dad, but every time we've encountered him, just stuff goes horribly wrong. It's not fun.
Yeah, just don't want him around.
Yeah.
You bring bad mojo.
Yeah. I mean, he brings, you know, car crashes and, you know, hit by vehicles or Cybermen invasions. Just that, this is not the stuff you bring to a party, Dad.
Bad news bears. All right. Well, that should actually, funny you should mention, dear Pete and everything on the other side of the rift there, because we'll be mentioning that as one of our items in tonight's news. You guys ready to jump in?
Yes, please.
Yep.
News. Okay. Let's close this horrid discussion. of Mark Gatiss. I think we've talked about this man enough for the last couple of weeks, but as we did give him the opportunity last week to win us over with his Empress of Mars episode, right after we recorded, an article released where he was talking about the issue that he took with the casting of characters in his episode, and specifically, he had an issue with casting people of color as a Victorian soldier of the British Army until, and he voiced this repeatedly in his letters back to the production staff, until he read something that told him that there was actually a black soldier in the army, and then he was okay with it.
Yeah, you don't get a pass on that just because you changed your mind after you got some flack for it.
No. I would have actually expected something better because it seemed like Gatiss was really pushing very hard to try and move the needle with regards to colorblind, genderblind, alignment blind, identification blind casting, and really just going with this is the best person for the role.
Mm-hmm.
But apparently he's not quite there yet.
Well, you know, this,
like, you can almost understand if you're casting for a role where race is going to play a part in the story that's being told and the character that's being shown. Mm-hmm. But that was not the case with any of the soldiers that we saw.
Yeah. And, and I mean, the thing was, is that it fit the theme that we had early on where, you know, the fish episode, I can't remember the name of it now, but when,
Thin Ice?
Yes, Thin Ice.
The fish episode.
You knew what I was talking about.
Slapping dance.
When Bill brings it up and the doctor just shrugs and goes, you know, history's a whitewash. Like this is the perfect example of that. No, yeah. You might not have found it. You might have thought that they were all white because that's just how it is. And it wasn't until it got brought up after the episode had aired that I realized, okay, why was this a problem? And the fact that he was complaining about that there were no black people in Queen Victoria's army, I'm like, you know what? There weren't any of Queen Victoria's army on Mars either, but you don't seem to have a problem with that part of the script, do you?
Yeah, precisely. You're dealing with a show where you have a cross-species lesbian couple with a clone alien butler. And you're worried about the fact that, no, someone's going to pull out of this episode. They're not going to be invested in how good of an episode I've written.
That person's got just a touch too much melanin.
Yeah. You know what pulls us out of an episode? iBooker monsters. That'll pull you right out.
So anyway, yeah, we're back. Everything is right with the world. I can now despise Mark Gatiss as a Doctor Who writer again. So,
yeah. Well,
in our chat, Jay was like, you made me say nice things about Mark Gatiss, and it comes out.
Well, now you can just throw a little bit of extra frosting on top of that cake, because he's also said that he's pleased that he was not given the opportunity to take the showrunner mantle.
Hey, we've got something in common, Mark.
Oh, boy.
No, so he actually phrases it and says that being in charge of Doctor Who is a poison chalice. It is a great opportunity, and everybody, you know, you look at it and it's like, this is a dream job, but there is so much hassle that comes with it. I mean, look at everything that Moffat has been through since he took over the show. Fans are ravenous for the show. They're rabid, and you are the face of the show now. you know, aside from the Doctor, like, you're the one that's pushing the agenda. You're the one that's approving scripts and stuff like that. So you are instantly going to be the target for anything the fans don't like.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's, he said as much. I mean, he watched what Moffat had gone through, because obviously, you know, working right alongside of him, both to a certain degree within Doctor Who, but obviously seeing the pressures on the Sherlock productions as well. But he says, you know, as he sees it, it was a relief not to be asked. Okay. All right. I'll take you on face value on that one. He said, but if I had been in charge, I would have canceled it immediately, just out of spite. But he never really had any huge plans to take on that kind of a role. So he wishes the best to Chris Chibnall and knows that he's, for all intents and purposes, he's walking away from the show too. Sorry, Jay, stop bouncing in your chair. But that's, he's about as close to being able to see the emotional, the physical, the psychological toll on the showrunner, but probably more so than most people could, because of his working so closely alongside Moffat. So, it's a fair assessment to make. I just think that based on your opinion of Gatiss, you could either see that as a, yeah, that's nice, move on, or thank goodness, or, well, all right, well, respect your opinion, but no one asked you anyway, so move along.
Yeah. Well, the next news article we've got, talking about showrunners, we've got this article here about Chris Chibnall as the man who reinvented the cliffhanger.
Yeah. This was a weird article to read. So weird that it's listed in the publication for the Royal Television Society. For a while, for about 3 days, this article was taken offline and then put back, and it's slightly edited. I don't know whether, you know, what the whole story was behind that, but if you pore through it, it's an interesting article altogether. Half of it, more than half of it, really has to do with Chibnall's work on Broadchurch. Okay. Which, based on the first season, you could say, yes, this was one of the most adept uses of the cliffhanger concept. And an ensemble cast where everybody had something on everybody, and it was this amazing piece of work. Second and third seasons, take whatever opinion that you will out of them. There's lots of reviews for and against. But they do mention this whole section of him segueing into Doctor Who and being able to apply some of that dramatic construct. I don't know if I'd say that he reinvented the cliffhanger, because I don't really think the cliffhanger has been reinvented. There's just people who do it well and people who don't.
Right.
How that applies to Doctor Who? Doctor Who uses cliffhangers all the time. So I would expect him to be able to apply that idea of, okay, suspense building is critical. This is a show that hedges its way between historical fiction and science fiction on the backs of really good suspenseful stories. That's it. You don't have to take it any farther.
Yeah.
So I don't really know. Some people read this article and said this instills them with hope. Like, well, I didn't really know a whole lot about Chris Chibnall. I didn't really watch a lot of Broadchurch, so I don't really know a lot of backstory on this. But if this is accurate, then I'd take this on as saying that this gives me a good sense that, you know, that we're in good hands. Someone else reads that and says, this writer kind of, this was a bit of a fluff piece or what have you, and takes it as such. I don't know. I'm going to leave this one out there, because I read it twice. I was pleased with it at one moment, and then I was worried about it, because there was a line in there where Chibnall says, I can't listen to all of the opinions and the criticisms and things, because otherwise it's going to get in the way of the story that I want to tell. Mm-hmm. And I worried about that a little bit, because think, if you're not at least cognizant of what people are positive and negative for, how are you going to write something that you know people are going to watch? And that was my big takeaway from this. And I still don't know how I feel about that, because that line, I don't know if it was just pulled out of a greater context. But did you both get a chance to kind of skim through this?
A little bit, yeah.
No, but commenting on the thing you just said, remember we've talked before about the difference between the fans of the show and the audience of the show. Mm-hmm. And the criticisms you're going to hear are going to be more from the fans of the show than necessarily the broader audience. So maybe that's more what he means, is that he's not going to cater it to the people that are complaining the loudest.
Right. Well, he knows how to pull ratings, and he knows how to create characters that are interesting to watch. granted, he was doing so within the broad church backdrop. You're watching it because it was like watching a slow motion tumble down a hillside. And every tumble you see a character go through, you're like, oh, they're going to break a clavicle in the next spin. Oh, that's a forearm. Oh. And you couldn't stop watching. It was horrific, but you were locked into it because the characters were, you got invested in them. At least again, first season probably being the most exemplary. And for those of you who choose to go ahead and just watch the first season, you can stop right there if you want to, because it's a beautiful story told start to finish and you get your resolution. But when he makes that kind of a statement, if that's the case, Haley, and it's not a matter of, I'm not going to listen to fans, I'm really trying to appease viewers, then it's got to be the numbers at the end of the day. And we've been talking about the concern, at least on home turf, about what the numbers Doctor Who has. So does this go back to some of the rumors going around that the controlling entities are being forced to say, you know what, go back to a Tennant sort of casting. We want the attractive lead and the youthful vigor, and we need to sell merchandise, and we need to get, you know, the equivalent of butts in seats. So, I mean, is that the kind of the vibe you're getting from that?
I don't know. I don't really have enough information, I think, to go on.
I think, I mean, the thing is that at the end of the day, yes, we've said it before, we've said it a number of times, this is a business. The BBC is going to put whoever's in charge that is going to do the best thing they can for the business, not for the show, not for advancing character arcs, nothing like that. So I think the fact that Chibnall is taking it upon himself to say, no, there's a story that needs to be told here, I think that it's going to be the best of both worlds. Is the BBC recognize somebody who can make a successful show, who can bring in the audience, who can do that kind of thing. And Chibnall is pushing back a little bit, being like, yes, I'm going to get as much of the audience as we can, but I'm not going to sacrifice the story that I want to tell to do that. So I'm hoping that it means that there's going to be a nice middle ground.
Okay. Well, on a less controversial note, but I think an equally interesting note, I personally was handed a gift this week that had me, if I didn't have a stand-up desk at work, I would have been bouncing in my chair. So I was probably just hopping up and down in the office if videotape exists. We have already been prepared come November of this year for Big Finish to give us our first foray into the Time War proper with Paul McGann. So seeing that that early step towards, you know, where we would end up seeing the War Doctor later, you know, and what was that path? What were those experiences? Mm-hmm. You often wonder, if we know that there's this cloudy period in the Doctor's timeline, there's another Time Lord who's there before, during, and after, who we also got to wonder, what was he up to during all this? Well, we will be getting a look at the War Master. And of course, if you're following your chronology of regenerations for the Master, that would mean that you'd have essentially none other than Sir Derek Jacobi as your Master. I can't wait for this.
Yes.
I don't know which one of these releases I'm more excited about now. I was thinking about that this morning. I'm like, I know that McGann's just going to absolutely kill it with his story, but this is a total unknown. This is totally new territory.
Right. And the fun thing here is that you've got to think that they're going to do some kind of overlap with the War Doctor stories and that kind of thing. But if you follow the path of the show, the Doctor's never going to be able to know that the Master's there, because he didn't realize, if we've got Sir Derek Jacobi playing the Master, he doesn't know that that's the Master come human nature
So when you meet Professor Yana.
Yes. Yeah.
But this also, the great thing about this is, and this is one of the things that Big Finish does so well, is you end up with non-Doctor stories where your antagonist is your primary character, and they're just awesome. If it's the Davros series, if it's the Dalek Empire series, you know, and you think, you know, how am I supposed to listen to a story where the baddie is your primary, and who's your goodie if you're bad? Wait, how? What? And the only people that you have credited so far, because this is going to be hitting us sometime in about mid-December, Sir Derek Jacobi is a War Master, and the only other voice credit you have is Nicholas Briggs as all the Daleks. That's it. That's all you have to go on. So, and granted, this is probably Nick Briggs's concept to run with in the first place. So he's got the first story installment.
Of course.
We have an entirely new writer in Janine Jones. She's been super, super excited on Twitter about this, that she's getting her first opportunity to have a full release at the helm there. James Goss, whom we love, coming back, and Guy Adams as well. So strong, strong story writing, but we're dealing with, and it's kind of nice that it's a four installment. A lot of times I was starting to fall back on having the three chapter big finish story. So it's kind of cool to have this as four. So get your orders in now, because you can get it for $20. You really can't go wrong. I've already thrown down my money.
Oh yeah.
But yeah, this is cool. Yeah. I'm just really, really excited about this. Yeah. So, and I'm hoping, based on Sir Derek's schedule, that this is something that will be, they didn't list this as volume one, but I'm hoping that it's something that will carry through. I guess we'll have to see how they wrap the story up in the fourth section, the Heavenly Paradigm, and see whether it's something where they leave the door open to be able to do another series with it. Yeah. So cool. Get in on that.
All right. So last bit of, I guess, news that we'll say today, the last 30 seconds of yesterday's broadcast of the Next Time trailer.
Yeah. Okay.
I
have theories.
Things have gone off the rail big time. Yeah. So we've been talking about it, how we constantly expect the companion to take over the role of the doctor. You know, we always have that one episode where the companion gets to be doctor. You know, last time Clara actually called herself the doctor, you know, so we've been waiting for that moment for Bill to take the lead on something. And then everything just took a hard left. And now we've got Missy being the doctor.
Yeah. Missy as the doctor, Missy out of the TARDIS.
Yeah.
And then obviously we get thrown these two, the sort of 1-2 punch in the final seconds that, okay, here's where we're getting the Cybermen from Mondas and a quick glimpse of Sim. So is anyone thinking that this is going to be just an alternate universe kind of pull here? I'm getting this funny feel, because if we're bringing back an iteration of the Cybermen who were not supposed to exist within a certain, you know, within this particular timeline path, and we're getting this asynchronous jump to the Sim Master, which hasn't been explained yet. I'm hoping that it's not, but I'm leaving the opportunity, or I'm leaving the door open for saying this could be something where we're getting kind of like the, help me out here, where we had the episode where history was breaking down.
Oh, the, shoot.
Yeah.
The Wedding of Riversong.
Okay. Thank you. And we had Centurions with Churchill and everything, and blimps in the sky with, okay. So, and I'm hoping it's not precisely. I'm hoping it's not going to just be another one of those. Well, if Woody had turned left.
Yeah. I don't think that that's what we're, I mean, just because, as you said, we've already had that once. Moffat doesn't typically rehash the same kind of plot like that. So
not that overtly.
Yeah. I don't know. I think that this is probably where we're going to see Moffat being like, hey, look how clever I was again. Mm-hmm. He's going to have some off the wall explanation that hopefully fits perfectly, but
or could it be something as simple as the Sim appearance as a flashback, and it's that innocuous? Because we had the same thing just happen when we were dealing with the Monks episode and the regeneration, that everybody was all, what was this early regeneration stuff, and it was all just a red herring.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't think that bringing Sim back and teasing it as much as they've been doing, at least in the news articles and stuff like that, I think that's a little too much to put into it just to have it be a quick cameo. It could technically be a flashback, but it's, I don't know, I think that we're gonna have some wibbly wobbly stuff going on here.
Okay. Glimpses through a rift sort of a thing, but that's what led me to think that maybe there are no consequences from this sort of thing, because he's as a result of whatever Missy at the controls. So where's she going to take you? And you end up being brought into alternate universes where, okay, the Mondasian Cybermen were the ones that persisted, or oh, she bumps into herself. Whoops, okay, that can't happen. Let's, you know, back the truck up, boop, 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 and, you know, and have to change tact. I'm hoping that there's more to it, but I really wouldn't be surprised if it were something where it was in there as a gift, Moffat doing something fun for his closing season, and just said, wouldn't it be cool? I just wanted to find a way to be able to utilize it. I don't know. I hope I'm wrong. I hope I'm wrong.
Yeah, well, we've got...
Bailey, you got a gut feeling on this?
We're getting to the end here. These are the last few episodes that Moffat had. I kind of want to think that he wasn't going to waste one of them.
Always... no question. Always being cognizant, though, of the fact that he's handing it over to somebody else shortly. And he doesn't just want to hand them, you know, a box on fire. I'll put this fire over with all the other fire. Yeah. Because he's always talked about, and we've talked about it quite a bit, about writers not boxing out their successors. And I think Moffat has so much respect for the show, for Chibnall, for the content, for the characters, for the universe, that he wouldn't do something entirely topsy-turvy and then just walk away, moonwalk out of the room.
Yeah.
So let's hope that his cleverness not only gets us into a great story, but gets us out of the story as well without consequences.
Hopefully. We'll see. We've got 6 days to wait before this next one drops. So yes. We'll see what happens.
Okay.
So yeah, next week we will be coming back with the world enough and time and see how this starts to unravel.
But yeah, this is going to be an odd discussion next week. This is about the point where I'm looking in my crystal ball and I'm seeing us in about 7 days time, and everybody's going to have this really kind of puzzled expression on their face. The hell did I just watch?
All right. Well, this has been episode 238 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is Jay saying, if I ever have to choose the way I'm going to die, I choose death by Scotland.
Yeah. Well, and this is Kier saying, I would have had something better, but Jay actually stole my line on this one. So I don't have a backup, and I'm going to turn it over to Haley.
This is Haley saying, I'm against it, against charm.
We'll see you guys next week.
And we'll see.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. We love getting feedback from listeners, so don't hesitate to share your thoughts with us. You can email us at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com, tell us on Twitter @GallifreyRadio, or on Facebook at facebook.com/GallifreyPublicRadio. You can also leave us a voicemail for inclusion in future shows at 210-802-1477. That's 210-802-1GPR. You should also go to GunnaGeek.com and check out lots of other high-quality geek-centric shows, or visit forums.GunnaGeek.com to talk about anything geeky with us or the community.